G'day, folks. So welcome back to the Complexity Premier podcast. My name is Christopher Joy. I'm a portfolio manager at Coolabah, and I'm joined by my colleague, Ying Yi and Chang, aka Yingers, who's also a portfolio management director. Yingers, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Chris. And hello, everyone, for tuning in.
So Yingers, we're at a crucial inflection point for markets. We're recording this on the 7th of April, and we have critical US inflation data this Wednesday. And we've had two consecutive upside surprises to the US CPI data. This is not the PCE measure, which is the Fed's preferred measure, but rather the CPI measure. In fact, there was also an upside surprise in December. So we've actually had three consecutive upside surprises. Thus far, equities have tried to ignore the very negative signals coming out of the US inflation releases, which we'll chat about later. But if we get a fourth consecutive upside surprise, I think it's going to be very, very hard. And we should, if this were to transpire, see some more equity capitulation and further upward pressure on bond yields, and therefore the discount rates that are used to price all assets. Regular listeners will know that Coolabah has relentlessly presented research suggesting that there is a risk that core inflation doesn't mean revert in a linear or straight line fashion back to 2%, and highlighting that we could get a re-acceleration in US inflation pressures, driven most importantly by demand side services inflation. Noting that the persistent services inflation is a growth effect on overall inflation, in contrast to the goods deflation we've seen, which is a much more temporary one-off downward influence on inflation as supply chains reopen. These demand-side services costs are being underpinned by incredibly tight labor markets. Here in Australia, the unemployment rate has fallen to 3.7%. In the US, it's fallen to 3.8%. And unsustainably strong wage growth. We've seen very brisk wage growth in the US and also very robust wage growth in Australia, in concert with re-regulation of the labor market at a time when labor productivity is running at its lowest level in circa 30 years. And it's precisely this context which makes the price action in March, where we saw a rally in both equities and bonds, notwithstanding the disconcerting inflation data, fairly unseemly, almost twilight zone alike. So in April, a few days ago, one of our most important forecasts for this year, which we had published in November 2023, calling for an upgrade to Australian Bank Tier 2 subordinated bond credit ratings in the case of the four major banks from the BBB+ level to the A- level was sensationally delivered by Standard & Poor's. And we can chat more about that later. Back in November 2023, we had also predicted that the regional bank senior bonds credit ratings, and in particular, the BBB+ ratings that applied to Bendigo and Adelaide Bank's senior bonds and Bank of Queensland's senior bonds, would also be upgraded by S&P in or around the first quarter of this year. And that likewise came to pass. At the time, we were the only global investors we know of that had identified this opportunity. When we spoke to Standard & Poor's and quizzed them on this, they said that no other investors globally had asked some questions on the subject. So with that introduction, Yingers, do you want to quickly give us an update on what happened to the portfolios in the month of March?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. So look, Coolabah's portfolios continued to deliver healthy returns in March, perhaps most strikingly accented by the recently established long duration unit class in our active sovereign bond fund, which returned 1.42% net of fees in the month. Our long duration global active credit fund, which delivered 1.24% net of fees, and our long duration local strategy called the Coolabah Active Composite Bond Fund, which is also an ETF, which returned 1.24% net compared to the benchmark composite bond index's 1.12%. It's noteworthy that over the past year, some of our best performing strategies have included the zero duration, daily liquidity, A+ rated long short credit fund, which returned between 13.65 to 13.81% net of fees over the 12 months to March 2024. Note that the Kiwi dollar and US dollar hedge versions of the fund returned 16.08% and 14.87% net of fees, respectively, over the same period. This fund has a current gross running yield of 7.31% per annum. The next best performing strategy is our zero duration daily liquidity A+ rated long short opportunities fund, which returned 12.61% net of fees. And this fund has a current gross running yield of 8.43% per annum. Next was the zero duration daily liquidity A rated floating rate high yield fund, which returned between 11.49 to 11.72% net of fees. This fund has a current gross running yield of 8.01% per annum. Then came Coolabah's new long duration daily liquidity A-rated global credit fund, known as the Pacific Coolabah Global Active Credit Fund. This is available to sophisticated investors only, and that has delivered 8.26% non-annualized net of fees since its launch on the 10th of October 2023, outperforming the benchmark Bloomberg Global Aggregate Corporate Index's 6.92% return. Note that is an Aussie dollar hedge return, and the outperformance has been 1.34% after fees. Moving on, our lowest volatility solutions, the zero duration A+ rated and daily liquidity Smarter Money and short-term income funds, which have returned between 6.41% and 6.48% and 6.51% and 6.77% after fees, respectively, compared to the Auswide Floating Rate Note Index's 5.44% and the RBA cash rate's 4.08%. And finally, our long duration daily liquidity A+ rated active composite bond fund, which returned 6.35% after fees, outperforming the composite bond index's 1.47% result by 4.88% over the last year. The fund's current gross running yield is 6.49% per annum. Now, please note, past performance is no guide to future returns, and you should always read the product PDSs to better understand their risks.
So, Yingas, tell us, what were the key asset pricing drivers in the month of March?
Yes, Chris. So, interesting question. Look, the coincident risk and bond rally was driven by a surprising retracement of long-term bond yields, and that's since reversed out in the April month to date. Despite a spate of worrying inflation data, with 10-year government bond yields contracting in the US by 5 basis points, in Germany, they contracted by 11 basis points, in New Zealand, by 16 basis points, Italy by 17 basis points, Australia by 18 basis points, and in the UK by 19 basis points. You get the drift. And this helped to push equities higher in Australia. So we saw the ASX 200 up by 2.6%. In the US, the S&P was up by 3.1%, while the NASDAQ was up 1.2%. In New Zealand, we saw the local stock market there up by 3.1%. In Europe, the Euro stocks was up by 4.2%, and in the UK, the FTSE 100 was up 4.2%. So lower bond yields have powered the performance of long duration fixed rate bond benchmarks, with the global aggregate corporate index up 1.26% in US dollar terms. Tighter credit spreads helped its zero duration counterpart return still a very attractive 0.86%, with corporate bond spreads compressing in US dollars down 6 basis points, in sterling down 6 basis points, and in euro down 8 basis points. Down under, cash credit spread performance was much more mixed. So corporate bond spreads only fell by 1 basis point, while 5-year major bank senior bond spreads were unchanged, and 5-year major bank tier two spreads actually widened by 4 basis points, care of ongoing issuance. One standout was the ASX hybrid market, where 5-year major bank spreads dropped by a striking 23 basis points. In synthetic CDS index markets, spread moves were generally much more contained, with US CDX index spreads only declining by 1 basis point, which was matched by a 1 basis point contraction in European main index spreads. There were, however, notable moves in the price of both oil, with WTI crude up 6.27% and gold, which appreciated 9.08%, that could influence and/or correlate with intensifying inflation. Now, looking forward, Chris, you mentioned the resurgence in the inflation data. What does that mean for asset pricing?
Yeah, Yingas, I think that's a key question. And the most important idea that we've been able to submit for this year has really been the crucial role that services inflation will play in the pricing of all assets. And I feel like a broken record. I've mentioned services inflation in every single column I've written this year for the AFR, and it's been a key feature of all of our recent podcast episodes. Recall, we began 2024 with the market expecting 175 basis points of rate cuts from the Fed, which the market expected to commence cutting rates in March. Months of strong services inflation, which has been pushing core inflation back up, has forced investors to radically reshape these forecasts. We now only have 75 basis points of cuts priced this year for the Fed, with the first one but a 50-50 proposition for the Fed's June meeting. And Ying is, I think that the real risk is that an otherwise dovish Fed will be compelled to delay interest rate relief until later in the year, if it comes at all, which might be politically inconvenient for some given the looming presidential election. The Fed's chair, Jay Powell, appears super keen to keep his imprudent dovish pivot from late last year intact, perhaps to ensure that his easing process starts well ahead of Election Day on November 5th to avoid the perception of any political impropriety. So the catalyst for the profound shift in market probabilities surrounding the next move in interest rates was the striking re-acceleration in the Fed's preferred measure of core inflation, known as the PCE benchmark. And this printed at 0.3% in the month of February, and we discovered this in April, with the prior month's estimate for January being disappointingly revised up from 0.4% to a very strong 0.5%. Significantly, this means that the trend pace in monthly annualized inflation in the US has leapt from a trough of around 2% late last year, which precipitated the Fed's silly dovish pivot, to around 3.5%. Worryingly, this echoes the bounce in the second key US inflation proxy, the CPI index, which has jumped from a low of 3% last year to 4% based on the latest data. And of course, we get an update to that data this coming week. The problem we have with the pivot is that it triggered a massive rally in risk and assets such as equities, crypto, and housing, coupled with lower borrowing costs in the form of tighter credit spreads and reduced risk-free rates, which in the technical lexicon is tantamount to an easing of financial conditions or, put more bluntly, a reduction in interest rates. What makes this frustrating is that almost all of the late 2023 deceleration in inflation has been driven by deflation or disinflation in the price of goods as supply chains have reopened. We've talked about this many times on the podcast, years, which is purely a temporary dynamic, as we've explained time and time again. And we've been no less relentless in asserting that the single most important question for investors this year is the path of demand-side-driven services inflation, which we thought would be sticky and could really derail the Fed's dovish direction. Because as goods deflation eventually peters out, strong services inflation, driven by tight labor markets and brisk wage growth, will inevitably force overall core inflation higher, which is precisely what has materialized both in the US and here in Australia. On this front, Coolabah's chief macro strategist, Kieran Davies, who is chief economist at ABN AMRO and Barclays and at NAB Markets, and also formerly head of forecasting at the Commonwealth Treasury, has commented that the pickup in US inflation has been very broadly based. And this is manifest in the fact that the estimated trend in the quote-unquote trimmed mean version of the PCE inflation index, which is a wider measure than the core PCE index, shows that the annualized monthly growth rate has re-accelerated from 2.5% last year to 3.75% in February. As we've mentioned now on numerous occasions, the main culprit driving the resurgence in services inflation is elevated labor costs. And in the payroll data, which once again surprised on the upside on Friday last week, we saw very robust average hourly earnings. And on our numbers, the trend in monthly core services inflation in the US is now running well north of 6% on an annualized basis, which is significantly higher than its pre-pandemic pace around 3%. We also see the same dichotomy between goods deflation and booming services inflation locally. On Coolabah's numbers, the three-month annualized pace of goods inflation has actually been negative 0.8%. So we have goods deflation. Well, the three-month annualized pace of services inflation has spiked from less than 2% in the first half of 2023 to 5.4% in February.
Chris, the biggest driver of services inflation is wages. And the Fair Work Commission is due to decide on the change in the minimum wage and award wages in a few months after boosting them by a staggering 8.6% and 5.75% respectively last year. These wage changes affect 25 to 30% of all workers in Australia. Now, the Reserve Bank of Australia believes that annual wage growth of more than 4% will make it impossible to normalize inflation if labor productivity does not quickly return to its pre-pandemic path. The Albanese government argues that the Fair Work Commission should not allow inflation-adjusted wages to fall, which means it's calling for an increase in minimum and award wages of about 4%. While unions are advocating 5%. A 4% rise would be incompatible with the RBA hitting its 2.5% inflation target unless we get a dramatic improvement in productivity. The present predisposition to re-regulate the upper market, including innovations such as the right to disconnect, will likely further undermine labour productivity.
Yeah, Yingers, and last week, the former RBA governor, Phil Lowe, had said, quote, "It's possible that interest rates will need to go up again because there's still quite a lot of underlying cost pressure in the economy." And he continued making a similar point to the one you just made. Quote, "If wages are growing at 4%, that doesn't make for 2.5% inflation unless productivity growth picks up." And then he added, quote, "There's still quite a lot of cost pressure in the economy, partly because productivity growth is so weak," end quote. I guess any investors aggressively long equities, real estate, junk bonds, and private debt have all been fervently punting on the likelihood of deep rate cuts this year to bail them out of a heavy pro-cyclical slump. The bottom line is the existential test for asset prices will be the next US inflation print. If it reaffirms the surge in services and overall core inflation, investors may face yet another regime change with non-trivial downside risks. And of course, seeing as these are being amplified further by the specter of ongoing conflict and tensions between Israel and Iran in the Middle East, which has doubtless contributed to the recent sharp rise in the price of oil to around US $90 a barrel, and coupled with the unsustainable nature of US fiscal policy, which is running a budget deficit that is about 8% of GDP and as big as anything we've seen in the post-World War II period, these factors may explain the record highs we're also observing in the price of gold.
Now, Chris, I want to talk about a second key Coolabah forecast for this year. And that was the view that S&P would upgrade the credit ratings on the major banks' T2 subordinated bonds and most regional banks' senior bonds, subordinated bonds, and hybrids. Chris, can you elaborate on this?
Of course, yes. Yeah, these are potentially profound moves, shifting the major banks' T2 bonds from the BBB+ to the A- levels pushes them into the all-important A band with all three global rating agencies, namely Standard & Poor's, Fitch, and Moody's, which in turn opens up a much deeper pool of global capital that can be then allocated to these assets. The same idea also applies to the senior ranking bonds issued by Bendigo and Adelaide Bank and Bank of Queensland, which would have their S&P ratings lifted from BBB+ to A-. Back in November last year, Coolabah was the first investor globally that we're aware of to identify that S&P was likely to improve Australia's BICRA score, or Banking Industry Country Risk Assessment score. At the time, our head of credit research, Jason Lindemann, wrote in November 2023 that, quote, "Global investors appear to be completely oblivious to the prospect of a very important upgrade to the major banks' T2 bond credit ratings with Standard & Poor's and Moody's into the crucial A band." And Lindemann continued, quote, "They also seem to be unaware that the regional bank senior and T2 bond ratings are also likely to be upgraded. Based on fundamental research by our team, Coolabah judges that there is a strong probability of an upgrade to major bank T2 bond credit ratings with S&P from BBB+ to A- and BOQ senior bond ratings from BBB+ to A- in the near term." And while this is an excerpt, he continued, "Coolabah assesses that S&P is likely to upgrade Australia's BICRA score from 3 to 2, lower is better, in the next 3 to 6 months." So, Yingers, this is precisely what S&P announced last week, which drove a reduction in the credit spreads on these securities. I think we have the major banks' T2 bond spreads some 69 basis points tighter. And it's plausible that these spread moves have a way to run, with some investors claiming that the spread multiple of the major banks' T2 bonds to their senior ranking securities should fall into line with multiples observed overseas, which are often 1.5 times or lower. The Aussie multiple has recently been sitting around 2 times, so there may be some upside there. In our portfolios, our largest positions for some time now have been in the bank's senior and T2 bonds. Having not really owned any of these securities in mid-2022, when we were seeking to protect capital by allocating it to interest rate hedged sovereign bonds. This is from late 21 to mid 22 by putting more than $10 billion of credit shorts and hedges into our books. But when credit spreads blew explosively wider in the first half of 2022, we started piling back into senior and tier two bonds at that juncture and have been trading those securities actively ever since.
So, Chris, what do you think the outlook is for returns in the sectors that we invest in?
Well, Ying is, as you mentioned at the top of the podcast, investors in our sectors, that is high grade credit and high grade fixed income, should have been able to earn after fees at least 11.5% to 13.5% returns over the last 12 months. I mean, that's what we've delivered in our strategies, I guess, noting, your disclaimer about past performance, et cetera. Currently, if you look at the yields as one measure across our portfolios in those same strategies, they're sitting at circa 7, 7.5, 8, maybe even 8.5%. So the organic income is very strong right now. It doesn't seem like cash rates are going to be cut super aggressively in the short term. The risk is that those cuts are deferred. And there is a possibility, as Phil Lowe noted, that we could get rate hikes, which would improve cash rates. We have liked averaging into duration. No, this is not personal financial advice. We've liked the idea of averaging into duration. For example, in my own portfolio, where you see 10-year government bond yields in that 4 to 5% zone. Currently, the US 10-year government bond yield has popped up to about 4.4%, having hit as low as 3.8% in January. I do think if we get disconcerting inflation data, which we think is more likely than not, we could see that 10-year government bond yield test the high fours or five again. We're probably only one bad inflation print away from that happening. But we are seeing, when we get these jumps in yields, even greater demand for fixed income. Indeed, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and every trader on the street I spoke to mentioned this dichotomy between very bullish yield-based buyers of fixed income and less enthusiastic spread traders or traders of credit spreads, noting that some credit spreads look very tight. In particular, high yield spreads look very, very tight. Private debt looks extremely expensive. So we really haven't seen much, if any, adjustment in the credit spreads or the extra risk premia you get if you allocate to high yield or to private debt, noting that US high yield spreads are close to post-GFC tights, despite the fact that we've seen a big increase in defaults, delinquencies, and bankruptcies. So just very quickly on that topic, Ying, is global corporate defaults this year, already in 2024, according to Standard & Poor's, are the worst since 2009, since the GFC. US bankruptcies in companies covered by S&P last year were the worst since 2010. Aussie insolvencies have soared and are the worst in about a decade. And if we're not going to get any interest rate relief, Ying, is this is only going to deteriorate. It's only going to get worse. And of course, we do have a very big increase in bond maturities from high yield borrowers or risky borrowers that need to be repaid next year and the year after that, which is likely to only apply further pressure to these very cyclically sensitive sectors, namely, zombie companies, high yield bonds, junk borrowers, and private debt. So, Ying, is on the one hand, I'm feeling pretty confident about the outlook given yields providing a lot of organic return. But on the other hand, I am, excited by the prospect of much more volatility because I think a lot of risky asset classes are priced for perfection with no real margin for error. Sectors like equities, venture capital, private equity, commercial real estate, high yield debt, and private credit. And if we don't get these deep rate cuts, we could see a lot more distress. And in particular, if we get an elongation in these services and core inflation pressures, we could see some significant capitulation and risk and possibly much more attractive spreads that we can capitalize on in the future. Well, folks, I think that basically wraps it up. Thank you so much for listening. Hopefully there was some informative content there. Please don't hesitate to reach out. You can email us direct at info@coolabarcapital.com. You can find me on Twitter at CJOYE, or you can look at my page or the firm's page on LinkedIn. Thank you.
This podcast does not provide financial advice. It is not an invitation to invest in any financial product, and the information in it should not be relied on for any decisions. All views expressed represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or a recommendation and should not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit the moneysmart.gov.au website to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.